are food for the soul, independent of which role you're in. That a relationship, that's what the book How Can I Help is about. That the way in which one gives and the way in which one receives, both of those feed both of the people involved, depending on how they're done. And the highest receivers are the beings who liberate through receiving. In a way, that means somebody who is physically very incapacitated and who needs great help. And they can be receiving that help in a way that fits in with their personality, in a way that they're angry and begrudging and guilty and everything. Or they can receive help from other people in a way that makes other people feel graced and blessed to have had the opportunity to help them. Right? And that way, everybody got fed in the process. So that the art of being a receiver comes when you extricate yourself a bit from your identification with that root personality stuff. To the point where I am a soul, you are a soul, we come together. What roles we're in is kind of irrelevant as to who plays which part. In a way, I mean, some of you may see me up here as a monumental ego, and undoubtedly that's also true. What I experience is that we are together here in the pursuit of truth, and that I am a mouth speaking the stuff that we presently understand, and that the questions you ask are our questions, and that we are talking to ourselves through each other, and I'm playing this part, and you're playing that part, and the parts aren't elevating or demeaning, and the parts don't have any giving or receiving. And when people come up and say, "Thank you," it always seems strange to me, because it's like one hand thanking the other. I mean, it's that close, because I feel like it's even more than family. It's consciousness that's exploring itself and trying to understand. Then the whole issue of giving and receiving disappears. Do you hear that one? Okay. Questions?
We've been discussing codependency in our small group and discussing the qualities, and basically we see that codependency is an addiction to the acceptance of other people, while at the same time we're on some levels self-rejecting. Because of that need for acceptance, we do rescuing, and we develop boundary problems. We make other people's problems our problems. The question here, I'd like to discuss the use of healthy boundaries on the part of a therapist or healing professional.
Got it. It was a quite an intense sequence you went through, because, I mean, each one of those is a whole issue of codependency, and then the way in which we get involved in taking other people's stuff on and lose our boundaries to them. First of all, to understand to take the larger laws and bring them down into form, when you reflect about the fact that everything in the universe is lawfully related to everything else, then in some way everything is interdependent and within the laws of form, that is, within form. So your personality and your thoughts are forms, and therefore they are all lawfully related to all other forms. Okay? Now, I can't spell out all the implications of that, because that's hours of reflection, but let's just take one example. That your Your needs determine, as I said the other day about hunger and stuff, your needs determine what you see in the world. So if you and I walk down a street, we see two different universes that are determined by our histories and our needs. And therefore, we pluck out of the universe what we need in relation to who we think we are. And who we think we are includes you as well as me, right? In order to make ourselves complete. And so each of us at the level of personality is constantly using the universe full blast in terms of who it thinks it is. All right? And there's no way out of that within personality. As you extricate yourself from identity with form, and that's what awareness is about, and pulling in and context of witness and all that stuff, as you're coming back out, you begin to see the laws of form at play, including your own patterns of, I feel inadequate, I can prove my adequacy if I do good, and you tell me I've done good. Therefore, I do good, and since I feel so inadequate, I keep doing good and doing good and doing good until I'm burned out and starving still. Because I can't really hear you saying I'm doing good except for a second. I mean, we all know these patterns. I'm just repeating them. But you can stand back where you can see the whole pattern. Now, in the terms of that has become, since Castaneda's books, become a kind of an interim impeccability, which existed before Castaneda, but it's a nice term. It's the question of how you lead a life impeccably. And it's clear that when you are caught in the dream, it's very hard to be impeccable. When you are in the world but not of the world, as Christ said, and when you're resting in relation to it with perspective, you're able to see, like when you play Monopoly, for example, if you get so emotionally caught in the game, you become a less good Monopoly player in the total warp and woof of Monopoly. You're not as good as if you keep some contextual framework from which you appreciate the game of Monopoly. Because the game of Monopoly is many levels. It involves who you're playing with and what the meaning of it is and how deep it is and so on. And you've all played with people who really destroy the game through the how much they're entrapped by it. So part of it is learning how to be an impeccable player without being trapped by the play you're in. And that's true whether you're a father or a mother or a therapist or a business person or an engineer or a client or whatever, is to how to be impeccable. Impeccable means that you fill the role perfectly and at the same moment you're not entrapped by it, so that you don't entrap another person by the role. So when you look down at the way in which you serve, you see that part of impeccability is defining limits, defining boundaries, saying, with the degree of consciousness I now have, I am able to convert only so much stuff back into spaciousness before I get trapped. And once I get trapped, I burn out. So I have to learn how to say no without closing my heart. The Kabir line, do what you do with another person, but never put them out of your heart. And that is an incredible exercise. Practice learning how to say no to another human being without closing your heart. We talked about that before. The root cause of the codependency is what happened when you closed down initially from being all of it to being just part of it. When you closed down into your somebodyness, into your separateness. When you went from being the entire universe, which is the way you start out, and then you pinch the bedpost and you pinch your toe, and you pinch the bedpost and you pinch the toe, and then pretty soon you develop a conceptual model that something's different, and slowly, and your parent is constantly reminding you that you're somebody, and pretty soon you buy it, and you start to contain yourself into it. Now, there's a very interesting edge there that I got an interesting thing from
my ghostly friend Emmanuel, who said something interesting. Because before you break down, your boundaries are wide open, which means your heart is wide open and you are in an unconditional space. You're not conditioned yet by mind. So it's all flowing in all directions. What Emmanuel said is about love. All love is unconditional, and yet it must move through the filter system of human fear. The moment love touches the vocabulary of fear, it becomes conditional. Why? In your infancy, you were aligned with love in its perfection. When the moment of separation came, and it must in this schoolroom, you realize that you and mother were no longer one. Since you knew that all you were was perfect love, the child's mind registered the message, this is an interesting message, that unconditional love was the cause of separation from oneness. You hear that one? It's an interesting reversal. One walks warily after that with the business of unconditional love. That's far out. I mean, if you can hear that one, it's an interesting little fillip on it. That what was that closing down? What was the cost of that closing down? What did it leave you with? Because if I study people's personalities in psychology, I see that at the root of almost every psychology is a feeling of inadequacy, of not enoughness, of somehow bad, that I'm bad, that I've got to do good in order to be enough. And that's why Freud got caught in the fact, or I don't know if he got caught, but Freud focused so much on you could get from negative to zero. That was about as far as the whole personality went. You never got into positive things. It was Jung that said, hey, there's something else here. But Freud only could get from negative to zero. And Freud interpreted it as the id, which was the uncontrolled anger, aggression, consumption, you know, all these things, was punished. But you could also see that what was punished was just the free play of form was punished. And you got so that you were afraid to open up. And Freud said you're afraid to open up because you're afraid of your impulses, but you can go one level behind that and say you're not only afraid because of your impulses, but they themselves are part of the total thing of oneness in the universe. Because oneness in the universe includes chaos and cosmos, order and kind of right at that edge of stuff. So it's very difficult to get hold of that stuff because it's so rooted at the root of personality. What you can do is philosophically understand these issues and intellectually understand them. And then, you know, you're almost compensating for it. You're looking at your life situation and you're seeing that you're open to that pathology just like everybody else is, and that you are doing this thing which is doing service in a way that's ending up making you feel, you're using other people to make yourself feel adequate. And the root process to go at is always going in behind to come back to the place where you just are. A lot of people try to counteract the I am not good enough with I am good enough. In other words, they take the opposite and they try to invest it. That still keeps the world at the level of polarities. The art is to go behind the polarities. So the art is to go not to the world of I am good to counteract I am bad, or I am lovable as opposed to I am lovable, but go behind it to I am. I am. I am. And I am includes the fact that I do crappy things and I do beautiful things. And I am. And that includes everything, and I am. And as you start to rest in the I am-ness, from that place you can start to set boundaries on the way you play the game and become more impeccable in the way you play it.
I have a connotation of letting go as losing. If I let go, I lose and you win. So my question has to do with how can I let go or surrender without feeling like I'm losing a part of myself or I'm losing.
Uh,
I think you're talking about relationship with other people, huh? Letting go. Is that what's in your head about that?
Yeah, I'm specifically thinking in my head about some work relationships I have where it, my model of what's...
Well, you're right.
Yes,
yeah.
The need to be right.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, finally, you want to be free more than you want to be right, and there's no rush. You just be right as long as you can, but you'll see that rightness is a really tight little box that isn't much fun to live in. You can be right, but you're not. It's very constraining. And after a while, you can be right and still just give up because it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter that much.
So how do I get over the feeling of losing?
Just examine it. It's the feeling of great loss. And it's just really hard to lose, to not win by at least working it out with the person so that they somehow acknowledge that you was probably right, but or at least you might have been right or something. But just, it really is a hard one. It's a hard one. But the in the terms of the long run, now sometimes, I mean, I'm not saying you always don't call a person on it, but there is a way in which you will see the many times when righteousness cuts you off from the flow of things. And you can end up right, but you look at the people that ended up right and you just don't want to be like them. They are really tight and cut off from the world inside. You feel the dryness of them. And I really keep finding what's happened. I notice in my human relations, I mean, I noticed it from wolves, that they always, when they're in a battle, one of them turns up its neck and then the other can't bite. Shows its jugular. Well, there's a certain way in which when I'm locked in a situation with somebody, I've gotten to the point where I appreciate that in human dynamics, if I find myself in a situation in which that person is them and they've done this to me, I now can flip gears and I can see that who they are is who they are. They're like a tree. They're a phenomenon occurring. They didn't do it to me. They did it because they're doing it. They, like, stole or screwed me or did something because that's what they do. I entered into a dynamic with them and I use them to do it to myself. So the responsibility lies with me. It doesn't lie with them. That's the first one. That when I quiet down in a moment in a debate with somebody, I see that I'm using them to do it to myself. That's the first thing. I accept responsibility for it. The next one is that when I accept responsibility for it and say, oh, it's okay, I was just doing this to myself, and I keep laying down before them, then it's interesting that if I watch plot the way it usually works, after a while, they end up being in a safe enough space to examine their own predicament and begin to see the way in which they also were using the situation in a way that was not healing to the world. And they often are very, very open in allowing their own culpability in a situation only after I have gone out of my way to acknowledge my culpability. And that's a very interesting... you can't use it as a strategy to get them to do it. You do it because whether they do it or not is their karmic predicament. You're doing it because you're dealing with your karma. And then in a sense, you've created a situation where they feel safe to then examine themselves. So I'll often say, well, you know, I really apologize for whatever suffering I've caused you in this situation. And we start to work from there. And then after a while, they will come forward and they'll examine themselves and they'll say, well, you know, maybe I was dot, 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 dot. I mean, we are faced all the time with being right in the presence of a world that doesn't understand rightness. You know, and there's a way of representing that's what's right. When you emotionally get attached to it, when you get attached to a model in your head of how the world ought to be that excludes the way human beings are, there's something wrong with where you're standing from where I'm sitting. Okay? I think you should be standing somewhere else. I just watch the facial expressions of people who are right,
who have a model of how another human being should be that other person isn't living up to. And I watch that they close that person off in their zeal to prove that person is wrong. There's a way that they do it that is harsh to the world. And it's not a full appreciation that other person is them too. I mean, there is not a corruption in the world that isn't in me. Really isn't. I mean, all of the corruptions of all the people, I mean, a Hitler, all of it. I mean, you just have to... I was an analyst for enough time to know you just scratch the surface in anybody, and the violence and the cruelty is in every human being. And if it makes you feel better to externalize it, and the immorality and the willingness to cheat and lie and steal, it's in everybody. And the minute you externalize it to judge another person, there's a way in which you're cutting yourself off from the truth of the fact that we are all of it. And when you recognize that we are all of it, you can oppose somebody the way Gandhi said, I want the British to leave, but I want them to leave as friends. You can oppose somebody in a way and disagree with them in a way that brings them closer and allows them to share with you the human predicament. Those are good social exercises to work on. Questions?
My question has to do with surrender. Tuesday, Susan was showing me the altar and the M&Ms and the pictures and the flowers, and I was asking her many questions about it, and she mentioned the word surrender. And I felt this clutch in my stomach. And I realized I have never dealt with that. And I've struggled with it for many years. And I know it's rooted in early shame and humility. But I know it seems like there's more to it than that. And I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Surrender. We usually think of the term surrender in third chakra power terms. We think of it in terms of somebody surrendering to somebody else, in terms of loss of power or giving one's power over to them. Surrender in the spiritual terms is more of a dissolving of boundaries of you into something else. It's, they say in spiritual work, the surrender that is true surrender is no surrender. That the model, I am going to surrender, is another ego place of power. Like, look how I am surrendering. It is an issue of my giving up control, and it's a control mechanism to say I'm giving up control. You can feel that what's happened to you in various spiritual practices is some of them you come to and nothing happens. And somebody says, this will be wonderful for you, but nothing happens. And you feel a little guilty because you can't surrender to the practice. Like for some of you, the mantra works, for some it doesn't. For some, the chanting works, for some it doesn't. For some, the meditation works, for some it doesn't. The interesting issue is, how do you deal with that? Do you feel somehow it's your lack? Do you feel that you have to judge the method, that the method isn't good, or that I'm not good? I learned a line that came, that I worked with a lot, after a lot of time, because I came up with this issue many times, against it many times, with teachers and so on. I just said, we have no business together at the moment. And I trusted that intuitive part of me that opened when it was in the way of things in terms of the unfolding of my being for it to open, for the surrender to occur. And surrendering meaning opening to and embracing into oneself, opening to and offering oneself into. Like a mantra, you start and you're doing it, and then if you keep doing it, there is a subtle place where pretty soon the fact that you're doing it becomes less the issue, and at some moment it shifts, and there's this a little click, and then suddenly the mantra is going on, and you are being done by the mantra. You can feel there was just a shift in orientation. When you're singing, sometimes you're busy singing, and then the singing carries you, and after a while you've just felt so safe, you just opened, and the singing is carrying you. At that moment, you could say from outside in, you'd say, well, she surrendered into the chant. But actually, you didn't experience it as I surrendered, which seems like a model of giving up something. It was something where you just opened into it. And I think that's a much more productive way of understanding surrender within the spiritual tradition, rather than I must surrender to something. I don't think one doesn't have to beat down one's ego for God. That isn't the way it works. The ego isn't in the way, it's how we're holding the ego. And it's much better to just do the spiritual practices and open to God and love God and trust your intuitive heart. And as the transformation changes, the ego then becomes this beautiful instrument that's available to you to deal with the world. It's not in the way anymore. Do you hear what I'm saying?